CKW 95.9 FM. My name is John Dick, and I'm here with community nutritionist Mary Jane Eason to discuss topics of healthy living, environmental issues, what's going on in our community, as well as other interesting things in this one-hour show. Every Friday morning on Wooden Spoons, we speak with guests on today's relevant issues, share nutritious recipes, and explore important topics with perspectives not found in the mainstream media. Time right now is 8 a.m. and the temperature outside is 19 degrees. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Morning, John. Good to see you this morning.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Yeah. Did you have a good holiday?
I think so. Yeah. I feel like the wildfires kind of, ruined a lot of outdoor activities this summer. But,
yeah, no kidding.
I think the weather was mostly pretty good aside from some rain.
Well, it's towards the very end of August. I could see that things were cooling down, like the smoke fog was going away. So it was, you know, changing.
Yeah.
So thank goodness for that. Anyway, we're back on air, and after a week of a month of being on holidays, I was on air last week as well. And just to have a quick rundown of what we're going to be doing today, I would like first to acknowledge that we are on territory, country one territory, the traditional land and waters of the Innu, Cree, Anishinaabe, Ojibwe, Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation and its territory for our life-giving water. And so that's the acknowledgement statement. And just a quick rundown of what we're going to be talking about this morning in Wooden Spoons. We have a guest, a return guest, Harold Schuster, who we will be interviewing shortly. I have some nutrition information to share, different topics related to, well, to nutrition and also to what's happening in our world, some information from Robert Kennedy in the United States government under the Trump administration, information from ECHO, that's another organization, and LEAD Now, an organic consumer organization, and we'll end up with a recipe. So this morning, I'm very pleased to welcome our guest, Harold Schuster. Well, welcome back to the program. Harold is a member of Independent Jewish Voices, a grassroots organization in Canada grounded in Jewish tradition that opposes all forms of racism and advocates for justice and peace for all in Israel and Palestine. Harold has been a regular guest, a regular monthly guest on Wooden Spoons, bringing listeners updated news, the events of Palestine under the Zionist Netanyahu government, things like that. And these efforts have brought a greater understanding of the issues for many people while promoting peaceful solutions. And so this morning, we will be discussing possible new directions taking place that may spell an end of the conflict, hopefully. Welcome to Wooden Spoons, Harold.
Good morning, Mary Jane, and good morning, John. Thank you very much for having me. I do want to comment. I agree a bit with John and how I feel the summer has been sort of disrupted by the wildfires and the smoke, and maybe it's part of our sharing the disruption from all of those thousands of people who have had to be evacuated because of those fires. I think everybody's summer was less than ideal, and hopefully things have cooled down. I know people are returning. I'm happy to be back, and while I don't have a food recipe, maybe I can share some ingredients for recipes for action.
For Africans?
No, sorry. Recipes for action.
Okay. Okay, that'll be good.
Things that people can do. Mm-hmm. I don't have recipe for things that people can cook. I do have some things that people can do.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. So, I will I forgot. I have to mention something, some information concerning some changes that are going to happen on Wooden Spoons, and we are going to be having a new person coming on, Marianne Sorelli. She's very prominent in the community. She's done all kinds of things, and she and her friend, they are going to be offering a program once, maybe twice a month, depending on probably at the end of this month, they will be doing their first program, and title is called Dialogues, Gravel Roads to City Lights. And the description of the show, according to how she describes it, will dig into differences and common ground between urban and rural cultures, exploring why people living in various parts of Manitoba have the beliefs that they do. And the dialogues, Gravel Roads and City Lights, is hosted by Marianne Sorelli and Kaylin Spain, who Kaylin Spain lives out in the country, so she represents the rural area. And the first show will be in the Wooden Spoon slot on Friday, September the 26th at 8 a.m. And they will start by talking more about the show and what influence, that's Kaylin and Marianne, they will be talking more about the show and what influenced them to take their passion for dialogue, mediation, and working across differences to CKUW. Marianne works at the intersection of education, politics, and community development. This show is a social innovation, part of the Politics of Unity theme that moves from debate to dialogue. One idea that won't leave her alone, Marianne, that's how she feels about it, and Marianne lives in Wolseley. Kaylin is a farm family coach and believes that conflict can be a catalyst for good change. She has education and training in conflict resolution and mediation and has worked with farmers of all sizes and strengths. She lives with her partner and two children on his family farm near Aarberg, which, by the way, happens to be close to the community that I grew up in, in the Interlake. So future shows will dig into differences in urban and rural life with an aim to explore common cross-cultural conflicts from various perspectives and experiences. Conversations with guests from both rural and urban Manitoba will look at underlying beliefs and ideals of everyday decisions and beliefs. So it'll be an interesting kind of program with dealing with conflict resolution, I guess, to put it precisely. So sorry about that, Harold. I wanted to make that announcement. So
no, I appreciate that. I've known Marianne for a long time. I have a great deal of respect for her work, and I'm sure listeners to that show will gain a great deal of knowledge and information. It should be very exciting.
Yes, it will be. So it's September 26th, that's the last week the last Friday in September. And they probably will start with once a month and until they get their, get their bearings. And then they're going to be taking over two programs a month, and they'll leave. I will be doing two programs, and they will be doing two programs. So, okay, so we cannot overlook just beginning to discuss these issues with you, Harold. We can't overlook the determination and atrocities being committed by the Zionist Netanyahu government. He's killing unarmed civilians, many of whom are women and children, shooting and killing the people who are bringing food to the starving populations, and attacking hospitals with wounded people. It just goes beyond the pale. No one can condone these atrocities. So do you want to comment on the actions of the Netanyahu government and what might be the consequences of these actions?
Sure. Thank you for that question. I mean, I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is doing exactly what every Israeli prime minister has done since 1948, and what the Zionist leadership wanted and needed to see happen prior to 1948, and that is to turn Arab Palestine into Jewish Israel. Netanyahu has only taken the necessary ethnic cleansing to an extreme level, to a genocide. So if you look closely at the history of the Zionist movement, and there's lots of material out there that listeners can access, they always knew and were quite open about the fact that the Arab-Palestinian population was not going to give up their land and their homes without a fight. We have now access to the history of the last 125 years from both sides. We, for roughly the first 100 years, the Zionists dominated the narrative, and for a variety of reasons, the world was happy to believe that story. But now Palestinians are given platforms to tell their stories, and it is a vastly different story to the lies and the distortion of the facts that Zionists have been spreading. Netanyahu, at least, is not afraid, and why should he fear any retribution for anything that his government has done or is currently doing? Netanyahu stated very clearly and with no hesitation that there will never be a Palestinian state as long as he is prime minister. And no Israeli prime minister before him has ever been serious about giving Palestinians the scraps that the partition plan of 1947 promised them. All the peace plans from Camp David to Oslo, even the negotiations that led to the partition plan in 1947, Israel has always found a way to sabotage the negotiations and blame the failure on the Palestinians. I think what Netanyahu's actions have done, what his government has done, what the ministers in his cabinet have said, have laid bare the truth of what the Zionist movement has always been about. And that, again, is the ethnic cleansing of Palestine to make way for an ethnically pure Jewish state. And as a result, the world, and by that I mean the developed Western world, is finally taking Israel at its word. Israel is as Israel does. And just yesterday, Netanyahu announced further settlement expansion in the West Bank and reiterated the claim that there will never be a Palestinian state. Now, if Israel refuses to reach a negotiated two-state reality, then the few remaining holdouts to recognizing the state of Palestine will make it a reality through the United Nations General Assembly, as was proposed 77 years ago.
Yes, that's putting it very, very clearly. It's a really quite a phenomena, that whole relationship between the Jewish population, the Zionists, and the Palestinians, and it seems to go back to biblical times. And perhaps there was always been a conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Do you want to comment on that?
Prior to 1947, right? And I think it's important for people to understand, for your listeners to understand, that this is not a race war. This is not a battle between Jews and Arabs. Prior to 1947, and, you know, certainly for most of the 20th century, Jews were welcomed to come to Palestine, to immigrate, to settle, to live their lives there, in cooperation with the indigenous Arab population. Christians had lived in Palestine for a long time, and the three peoples, for the most part, got along very well. The problem began, right, when Jews, under the Zionist ideology, looking for a safe place to live, which I've talked about in the past and which I think was the wrong suggested solution to a very real problem at the time, the issue became when Jews started to move into Palestine, not with the intent of living in harmony with the Arab and Christian populations, but by taking over the land, by introducing a settler colonial state that privileged Jews over other people living there. That's when the Palestinian Arab population took offense, and rightly so. Again, they were happy to welcome Jews who wanted to immigrate to come there. They were not happy when Jews came there to settle and to force them off their land.
That is a very important thing to be to remember, a very important understanding underlying this issue. There is also the bravery of the journalists who have come to the scene to report on what was happening. And what impact have journalists played in educating the public as to what is taking place? How have they played a crucial role in creating an understanding of the situation? Because I think there was very little understanding of the situation according to the mainstream media. But I think the journalists have brought out a new understanding. You want to comment on that?
Certainly, and I think it's important when you differentiate between sort of mainstream journalism, the kinds of media that at one time I think did provide a more balanced and nuanced telling of history, but currently most of the mainstream, and I sadly include our national broadcaster in that category.
Sorry.
Oops. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yes. No, that's fine. Yeah. So journalists, you know, when given the opportunity to report on conflict zones, and I don't mean just about reporting on military conflicts, but any number of stories that affect our world, from climate change and environmental catastrophe, when their stories aren't spiked, and spiked is sort of a term used sort of in newsrooms where a journalist will come with a story and the editor or the executives look at it and they decide not to run it. I think there used to be sort of an actual device on the editor's desk, the sort of a little thing with a little pokey thing sticking up, and they just sort of, you know, put the story on that and they would spike it. So when the stories aren't spiked by the newsroom executives, who I think these days are much more interested in protecting corporate profits than sharing the truth, they play a vital role and are critical for citizens to understand the world around us, to make informed decisions, and to hold governments to account. As for Palestinians, it has been even more difficult for not only their stories to be told and shared, but to be believed. And it's a sad indictment on our world. When it comes to Palestine, it is only after Jewish Israeli-based organizations like B'Tselem or Physicians for Human Rights, and these are wonderful organizations and I don't criticize them, but it's only after they started calling the genocide in Gaza a genocide did others start to take notice. It is only after the labeling of Israel as an apartheid state, only after Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and B'Tselem again used the word, did the world start listening. The fact that Palestinian journalists and writers and poets and filmmakers and musicians have been trying to make us hear them and listen to them and believe them for decades, it took others telling us the Palestinian reality before we chose to listen and to act. And there are about a dozen different Palestinian human rights and legal organizations who have been documenting the abuses of the Israeli government, the constant violations of international and human rights laws committed by Israel to maintain its control over every aspect of Palestinian lives inside 48 and the illegally occupied territories in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and of course the genocide in Gaza and the nearly 20 years of Israel's illegal siege on that territory. They have been doing that for years and years and years, and sadly no one was listening, no one was believing them, and that gets us to where we are today.
Well, that's a very good explanation of the situation. And it makes a lot of sense. So it's an uphill battle to get that the information out, and it is now out there, and I think it can't be put back in the bottle anymore. I think it's the tides are turning. I feel that the tides are turning for the Netanyahu government.
I would certainly agree, and public opinion polls point that out. Once people have been able to hear and listen to the Palestinian narrative, to place it side by side to the Israeli Zionist narrative that they have been fed for most of Israel history, they are smart enough and understand enough to recognize what is going on, and that's why they are demanding our government take action to make it stop.
And I think all the rallies, the pro-Palestinian rallies that have taken place in the city have been a great way of educating the public. I think there was it just created a lot of change. Like Peace Alliance Winnipeg has sponsored a lot of these rallies and others as well. And of course, journalists have played a very important role. And to me, that they have been martyrs to the cause, because so many of them have been killed, and it's against international law to kill journalists. So mm-hmm. I don't know. Netanyahu seems to get away with all of that.
It is quite remarkable. I mean, it is and it isn't. As someone who's been sort of following this and has been involved in Palestinian solidarity, who's had the opportunity to what I think anyhow is get a fuller and deeper understanding, having read Palestinian stories or reading Palestinian history and looking at the information that's now available, diaries of the Zionist leaders who talk very openly about the need to ethnically cleanse, about the need to remove the Palestinians. This what is happening today, if you follow it, is simply the sad and necessary end result of the Zionist movement. And we're talking about journalists. I read or saw something recently, and it may not actually have been a recent comment, but for Israel, the most dangerous weapon to them is a camera. And mm-hmm. this has been borne out by the fact that the Israeli Defense Force, the world's most moral army, has killed, and many were murdered, 248 journalists in Gaza.
Oh.
248. That is more than the number of journalists killed in any conflict in modern time. And they do it without any remorse. You know, yeah. There was a time, you know, when they would deny or obfuscate the killings, the murders, as they did with the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akla. At first, Israel denied it. Then it was a horrible mistake. Then they would investigate it, and then it was forgotten. And it's the same story over and over again with Israel. They lie, and they lie, and then they deny, and they deny, and then they say they will investigate, and these investigations are internal, of course, and the killer is exonerated.
Yeah. You're listening to CKOW 95.9 FM. This is Wooden Spoons. Our guest is Harold Schuster, and I'm with co-host John Dick. And my name is Mary Jane Eason. Did you have any comments, John?
Yeah, like my sense from like Netanyahu and what's going on is that the end goal is to basically annex Palestine. When he says like there will be no Palestinian state, does that mean that he actually wants to annex Palestine, or that just means it like, or what does that mean?
I would understand it as that. And I don't even know if he would use that terminology. I think we use that terminology because there's still some semblance of believing in international law. And international law states that a country cannot hold indefinitely land that it takes over through the war. And they can temporarily annex, and I think that's where the annex that land. But after the conflict, after peace negotiations, whatever land was obtained through war and conflict has to be returned. And what is happening in Palestine is that Israel and its defenders don't recognize Palestine as a state. And I think we'll get to a little bit of that later about, you know, what statehood would mean. So by not recognizing Palestine as a state, they don't believe that they owe that land or have any responsibility to give it back to anybody. Their claim is that it was always meant to be their land. All the land from the river to the sea was meant to be theirs. And they have no qualms about taking it. Ethnically cleansing it of the non-Jewish population. I don't know what that means for Christians who are living in that land. I know that they are under attack, and there are are many, many cries from the Christian community in Palestine for international support, because their churches are being bombed, their parishioners are not subjected to the same sorts of treatment, but simply by living in a war zone, they are afraid.
Yeah, it's a very bad situation.
Netanyahu means that he wants all of that land, it's Israel's, and it was given to them by God.
Yeah,
and God forbid should anybody try to stop him from
taking
it. Yeah,
this is such a blatant statement. There it is in front of everybody. It's just unbelievable that there's any support for Netanyahu at all. And then you do want to just comment on the group of the Hamas group who was being targeted as perpetrating the problems. What is Hamas? Who do they represent? And what would you provide the context that can explain their actions? Of course, you just did that, so.
Yeah, well, a little bit. And I'll try and give your listeners sort of a primer on Palestinian political organizing and their structures. But as you can imagine, it is a long and complex history. For the most part, it has operated outside of Palestine, and many of its leaders have been jailed or are in jail, and many have been assassinated. So in 1994, the Palestinian Authority was established as an outcome of the Oslo Accords. Prior to that, the Palestine Liberation Organization was the body representing Palestinians worldwide. The Palestinian Authority, or the PA, was meant to serve for an interim period pending final negotiations for the once again promised state of Palestine. And it's meant to represent sort of the non-diasporic Palestinians, the Palestinians who lived in Gaza, who lived in West Bank, and those who lived in East Jerusalem. There are some Palestinians who live inside 48, and they are they elect members to the Knesset, and are probably represented in some way by the PA, but it's a somewhat different status because they live inside 48. So now, with the establishment of the Palestinian Authority, the PLO is still the global representative of all Palestinian people. Right. So under the PA, there is the Palestinian National Authority, and that is led by the president of the state of Palestine, currently held by Mahmoud Abbas, who is the leader of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement, which we know as Fatah. There's also the Palestinian Legislative Council, and this is the legislature for the Palestinian Authority. And there are currently seven parties represented in the Legislative Council. So along with Fatah, there is the Islamic Resistance Movement. That is what we know as Hamas. And Hamas is the acronym for the Islamic Resistance Movement's name in Arabic. There's also the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. It's a party called the Third Way, the Palestinian National Initiative, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Palestinian People's Party, and a few independent candidates who sit in the Legislative Council. Now, there are also 18 parties that are unrepresented in the Legislative Council. So this gives your listeners some sense that mainly and most of the time, all we hear about is Fatah and Hamas. And those are the two largest parties. But there are many, many other parties and groups representing Palestinians. And as I say, these are political parties. So, as in Israel, there are, numerous political parties with, a variety of different approaches, different sort of organizational structures that, run the gamut from, left to right on the political spectrum. And that's no different with Palestinians. So the first election for this newly formed entity, the PA, took place in 1996. That election saw Fatah elect 62 members to the then 88-member Legislative Council. It's important to note that Hamas boycotted that election, and I don't know exactly what the reason or rationale was for that. Right? The Legislative Council now has 132 elected members. Half are elected under a system of proportional representation. Maybe we could learn something from the way the Palestinians hold their elections, eh? They have proportional representation. And that would explain why there are only 7 of the 25 parties that are represented, because 18 parties didn't, elect enough or reach a threshold to allow them to have members in the Legislative Council. And, I don't want to get into, you know, the nitty-gritty, the quagmire that is Palestinian elections, other than to say that they are in disarray. There has not been an election since 2006. And in that election, now these elections are supposed to happen every 4 years. So the first one was in 96. It actually lasted 10 years. There was another one in 2006. And in that election, Hamas elected 74 members to the Legislative Council and came to be the political representative of Gaza. In the 2006 election, Fatah elected 45 representatives. So in the Legislative Council, there are more Hamas members than Fatah members. I don't know why Abbas is still the prime minister, given that he is the leader of the party that has fewer representatives in the Legislative Council. But that election saw a major split between, you know, I would imagine an even bigger split than what was in existence prior to that. And that, again, I think is based on ideologies, on the different parties' approaches to negotiations with Israel, and as a result, there hasn't been an election since 2006. Abbas continues to be the president. Most of the Palestinians that I know and talk to here, no one is happy with the state of affairs and with their politics. But unfortunately, there's little they can do because Israel controls when and how elections for the PA take place. So Hamas, just quickly finish sort of on Hamas, right? So Hamas was formed in 1987, right? So it hasn't been there since 48. It only formed in 87, and it was an Islamist or a more religious-based party and was affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood operates your listeners probably heard in Egypt and other Arabic countries, and they are kind of like a social service agency, right? They provide a variety of different services, which is why, you know, when Israel talks about Gaza and Hamas, they talk about how, you know, everybody is a Hamas supporter or agent, and that's simply because Hamas, as the government in Gaza, employs these people. So they are by default members of Hamas because they work for a Hamas agency or some governing body that provides services in Gaza. Now, when Hamas formed in 1987, it was discreetly supported by Israel. Israel saw it as a useful counterbalance to the more secular nature of the PLO. So this was a divide-and-conquer plan by Israel to prevent Palestinian unity and to permanently postpone the establishment of this promised state of Palestine. Hamas, as with most Palestinian parties, are resistance movements who want and deserve to be free citizens on their land. Now, what motivated the actions of October 8th were the inhumane conditions that Palestinians were forced to exist under by Israel. They lived under horrible conditions with every aspect of their lives controlled by an occupying power. Gaza has been described as the largest open-air prison in the world. Most of the citizens of Gaza were refugees and the descendants of refugees displaced by the Nakba of 1948. Many can see through the fence that keeps them caged what were once their homes and their farms being inhabited and farmed by settlers. I cannot imagine the suffering, the inhumanity, the indignity of being kept caged like animals for 20 years. I can understand how that indignity could drive one to take extreme measures to gain freedom, to strike out against one's keeper in violent ways. When all measures of peaceful resistance, like the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, are criminalized, when the peaceful march of return in Gaza resulted in live fire from IDF soldiers, you force people to resort to violent protest. Now, I'm not condoning the violence or making excuses for the violations of international law that took place on October 8th. The International Criminal Court has laid charges against Hamas leaders, who will unfortunately never be able to face trial because they were killed by Israel. And the International Criminal Court has also laid war crimes against Prime Minister Netanyahu and his former Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant. At the same time, the worst atrocities claimed by Israel to have occurred on October 8th have been proven to be lies. There was no beheading of babies. There was no systematized rape or sexual violence. And for all the horror that was inflicted on Israel by Hamas and other militants on October 8th, it pales in comparison to the reaction by Israel. There can never be any justification for genocide.
Well, this is certainly an education into the political situation. And, you know, I really appreciate you sharing all that information. So it's certainly the Netanyahu government is should be charged for war crimes. I think probably he would be, but there are certain features in the political scene. Like there's this President Donald Trump. He has a lot to do with the aggression of the Netanyahu government, I would think. He supports their government. So do you want to comment on the influence of Western countries and like important powerful leaders such as Donald Trump, and what about our own prime minister, in how they are implicated in the ethnic cleansing and the brutality that is being inflicted on the Palestinians? They are implicated. How are they implicated?
Absolutely. And, you know, trying to understand President Trump is a game that I cannot even begin to imagine trying to navigate. He is and I've said this, but I think before, he lacks any of the, I think, the necessary skills of diplomacy and tact to be a leader of anything, let alone possibly the most powerful and influential country in the world. There's little that I can, you know, try to understand in his logic or his thinking. One day he wakes up and Netanyahu is his best friend. The next day he's mad with Netanyahu. One day he wakes up and Vladimir Putin is a wonderful person, and the next day he hates them. So I think what Trump has done as president is in many ways is not very different than what every prime minister or every president prior to him has done vis-a-vis their relationship with Israel. You know, the United States has used its veto power in the United Nations Security Council 45 times to veto resolutions against Israel, 45 times in the last 60 years or so. That's more than half of the times that it's used its veto power. So it's used its veto power more than 50% of the times that it's used it to veto resolutions against Israel. It's used its veto power four times since the current genocide, or since October 8th. It most recently used its veto power just this past June, when a resolution came forward calling for an immediate and permanent ceasefire to take place in Gaza. And all 14 other members of the Security Council voted in favor of that resolution. So the Security Council, again, briefly, it's got 15 members, 11 of which are 15 members, 10 of which serve on a rotating basis. Five countries have permanent status on the Security Council, and each one of those countries has a veto power. The U.S. has used its veto power, as I say, almost exclusively to prevent resolutions against against Israel. And again, this is no different. What Trump has done, what the UN American representative to the Security Council has done, is no different than what American policy has been towards Israel almost since its inception. I was trying to find, and I think that there was one time that under Obama, the U.S. representative abstained on a vote in the Security Council against Israel. And Israel, I don't know if I can say this word on your show, just about lost its shit over that. That is how valuable and important and compliant United States has been in its support for Israel. So what Trump is doing is really no different. I think Netanyahu did as much and was as intransigent as he was under past administrations, and I don't think it'll change going forward. I think it speaks to, and we can maybe talk about later, you know, Canada's role, that the United Nations, for all its failings, and it has failed many, many times, and you know, extraordinarily terrible situations have been allowed to continue because the UN doesn't have really good enforcement mechanisms. It's got a certain kind of moral authority, but when it comes to enforcement, it's all voluntary, and its votes and actions are voluntary on its members. And as a result, votes that happened at the UN, at the General Assembly, where all countries have a vote, all 193 members, I think, of the UN have a vote. But those votes, those resolutions, are voluntary on its members, and they're only as powerful and as impactful as the members make in living up to the votes and the resolutions and what they're being asked to do.
Well, thank you, Harold, for explaining all this. I think it's a very complex situation, but it's, you know, this might be, you know, I think Donald Trump is talking about building a Riviera in Israel, and I would like if he ever with the, you know, if he ever tries something like that, I think what his aim is to take over Israel. So Netanyahu might be caught in a trap. I think it's some kind of bizarre situation. But anyway, and then, of course, our own prime minister is wanting to recognize the Palestinian state with limitations. So there is some shifting happening. But we are running out of time right now. And we could go on forever. But thank you so much for joining us this morning. Harold, it's been a pleasure.
Can I just end with a couple of what I'm calling sort of my public service announcements?
Sure.
These sort of my recipes for some actions that people can take, because there's a couple of what I think are really important events happening quite soon. So as your listeners might know, there have been weekly All Out for Palestine rallies. We held our 100th just last week. I've seen you at many of them. This week, the rally is going to be behind the legislative building, where we're going to be building origami boats and setting them afloat in solidarity with the Samud flotilla. That currently there are over 50 boats that are attempting to break the illegal siege in Gaza and deliver the much-needed life-saving humanitarian aid to Gaza. So that's going to happen this Saturday. There's
what
also
time,
coming
what
up...
time on Saturday?
Sorry, noon. The rally's at noon behind the legislative building.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. And then next weekend, there are two really big events. An environmental action called Draw the Line, which is, I think it's a global call to action on climate justice, indigenous sovereignty, and peace. And that's going to take place at Premier Wob Kanu's constituency office at 565 Osborne Street. Then on Sunday, September 21st, is the, I think now it's the fourth annual Run for Palestine, the third annual Run for Palestine. I would encourage your listeners, even if they can't, it's a 5-kilometer run or a 1-kilometer walk. If they can't do either, to register, they can make a donation online. And we really want to try to sell that out. We really want to try to raise some money and increase the profile of what's happening in Gaza. And then finally, I'll end with on September 27th is the annual Walk for Peace that's being organized by Peace Alliance Winnipeg, one of the organizations that you mentioned, one of the organizations that does a lot of really good work here in Winnipeg. So the Walk for Peace happens on Saturday, September 27th, meeting at 7 o'clock at City Hall. And with that, I will leave it. And I want to thank you again for giving me the time to talk and be on your show. And I look forward to hearing Marianne's show.
Okay, thank you, Harold. Well, thank John. I didn't select a song. I don't know, Harold, if you have a song to select, or
I guess. Sadly, I didn't. I gotta have to leave it up to you.
Okay.
All right. I'm gonna say goodbye now.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks,
Harold.
Again, Mary Jane. Bye, John.
Okay. All right, bye.
So we're looking at a few possibilities here. What is this? Listen. What is that? It looks like violin.
Yeah.
That's a nice type of music, isn't it? We're just trying to make a decision here.
Yeah. So this is Black Violin, a flat. So put that on. Thank you. right, so that was a song A flat by Black Violin. It was just something that sort of appeared on our YouTube feed because I guess Harold didn't have a song request this time, which is okay. Anything to say, Mary Jane?
No, I think it seemed to be appropriate. It seemed to fit in with our theme.
Yeah, it did in a way. I was wondering, like, what song can we put on that fits? But that was happy coincidence.
Yeah. Anyway, we're just running short of time right here, but I wanted to... I just wanted to make a few commentary on some things that are Robert F. Kennedy under the Trump administration. He is doing some interesting work, and he's actually. I'm just going to. I'm not going to follow what I have, the information I have here, because there's quite a lot of stuff that he's doing, identifying certain causes for autism, and which he is linking to the mother's use of Tylenol, and also folate deficiency. And so he's been talking about that. Folate is a vitamin, like type of B vitamin, I believe, and it has been associated with spinal bifida in unborn infants. So that's why usually most foods are enriched with folate, because this is one of the protects from spinal bifida. But he's also saying that it's causing autism, not having enough folate, and the use of Tylenol by mothers that are expecting, enduring their pregnancy. Robert F. Kennedy is also a person that has been harshly criticized for his approach to messenger RNA vaccine, which is he does not want to use it, because there people may not know. I happen to have been watching a lot of his programs a number of years ago when my brother was still alive, and we used to watch his programs. Messenger RNA is one of the vaccines that, when given to some people, have caused a lot of harm. Now, Robert F. Kennedy, at that time, he wasn't in the Trump government, but he was very much monitoring the side effects, the harmful effects of vaccines. He was not opposing vaccines. He was monitoring the side effects, and just so that people can be aware that there are dangers, especially for some. One of the dangers from the messenger RNA is the replication of fibrous tissue, fibrin, it's called. And we've had guests on Wooden Spoons after the citizens' inquiry that came to town, to Winnipeg, right across the country during that time, to get people informed about what was happening with vaccines. And so one of those was vaccines. We had people testifying, a person that does autopsies, a funeral director, and saying that this fibrin tissue was discovered in bodies, what he had to deal with, which he had never seen before, only found in people who had been given the vaccine, apparently. This fibrin tissue builds up into your system, and it can cause heart attacks and so on. So I'm just saying that Robert Kennedy Jr. has received a lot of flack. Health Canada, Theresa Tam, has made statements in the Free Press. Most in Canada, Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, pardon me, when he was in power, he made it mandatory. He made a law mandatory for people to be vaccinated. They didn't have a choice. But there's always people who do not want to have the vaccine, and there are always people who have a bad reaction to this. So it wasn't really enforced. But Justin Trudeau purchased a whole bunch of vaccines from Pfizer, so of course they want to use it. So this is the case. Teresa Tam made some statements about people should be more scientific in their understanding of things. Well, I'm afraid that her science is very limited to corporate science. So we have to remember that there's a whole corporate power behind the vaccine push. They do not want anything bad to be said about vaccines. But I happen to know, and I know that, like, from what I've been hearing and seeing, and also have actually have had worked with somebody that had a vaccine reaction. He was a volunteer with our school, and he developed this fibrin tissues. He had all these lumps in his body. Since he got the vaccine, he had heavy, hard time breathing, out of breath, gained weight. It happened right after he had the vaccine, which he did for the to support his partner who wanted to be vaccinated and believing this, you know. So anyway, these are the kinds of things that are going on. I wanted to just mention that Robert F. Kennedy, I guess, junior in the Trump administration, he's the finer person in that administration, but he is taking a stand. He has, I say, he's very ethical, and he's saying the truth, how he understands it, what is being shown by the research. And so that's, I won't go any further. I have had a lot of ideas to share with from other organizations, but we have run out of time, and I believe I have time for a quick recipe.
Yep, 3 minutes.
Oh, 3 minutes. Okay, tomato mozzarella and basil salad. This salad originates from the Isle of Capri, and it combines three ingredients that harmonize well together: mozzarella, cheese, tomato, and basil. And you can also add avocados. So what you do, you cut the mozzarella and tomatoes into slices only a quarter inch thick. This is a simple recipe. Arrange the slices on a large plate and season with salt and pepper. Put a slice of mozzarella on each tomato slice and top it with a basil leaf, and then you tear the remaining basil leaves that are left over and scatter it over the top. Drizzle with a generous amount of olive oil. The salad should be made at the last moment to prevent the tomatoes from weeping and the mozzarella cheese from drying out. And then you serve at room temperature. You never chill it, as this would kill the flavors. So, and you can use an avocado by using, you have half and peel it, a ripe avocado. Remove the pit and slice the flesh, and you could just intersperse it on this platter, this beautiful platter, with sliced tomatoes and mozzarella and basil leaves. That's the recipe for today. Thank you for joining us at Wooden Spoons, and thank you, John, for being the co-host, and thank you, Harold, for being our guest this morning.
Yeah, for sure. You have been listening to Wooden Spoon, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKW 95.9 FM. For a podcast, please go to ckw.ca, type Wooden Spoons into the search bar, and the show will be up in just a few hours. Until next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening.